irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, inviting you for another wonderful evening of talk right here on LA Talk Radio. And we are on the line right now with the indubitable, fast-reading, slow-walking, slow-talking Bobby Jean Bell.
Oh, that's a new one. I wish I was a faster reader. I haven't learned how to not read every word. You know, I just haven't learned in 5 years, Jim. It still takes me a long time to read.
I'm like you. I mean, I got to say, and there are some books that I have to labor over every page. This week's book was not one of them.
No.
Look, let's open this show by saying we have a good friend that is getting married next week, and his name is Gary Holt from Equestrian Legacy Radio. And Gary, we from the Writer's Block, we really want to wish you just the happiest and happiest of days. Congratulations on your marriage. Let's hope it lasts longer than 2 months.
Oh.
And Gary, we have beat you by 4 listeners.
My dear friend Gary Holt and his bride to be Mary Kay.
Yes.
I do co-host a show with Gary for about the same five years or more, and known Mary Kay for even longer. And so delighted for the two of them. Very, very exciting. Yeah.
Well, Gary's a great guy, and he deserves some happiness. And yeah, we truly hope that's exactly what you're getting. So good luck. And well, I listen to Equestrian Legacy every now and then just to hear with my friend Bobby Jean Bell. It's one of the 4 shows that she does on the radio during the week. and if it weren't for Bobby, you know what? The truth is, when I put the show together, there was only one person I had in mind for a co-host. And she is my co-host, Bobby Jean Bell. So,
thank you, Mr. Christina.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm over here gushing. Right now, we have our first Thursday in the month guest, who is there's no stranger to the Writer's Block or to our listeners, Mr. Henry Park.
Well, thank you so much. Greeting, guys.
Hey.
Of course, you're welcome.
Thank you. Well, now, I was going to do one of those stupid, guess who I just got off the phone with, but there's no way to do that. We could do it all night. So I will just tell you, for Jim and me, at least, she's always going to be Lori Darlin, the lovely Diane Lane from Lonesome Dove.
Diane Lane, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, isn't she doing something new with Kevin Costner?
That's right. I was going to talk about that. Diane and Kevin star in a terrific contemporary Western thriller, Let Him Go. It comes out November 4th from Focus Features, and it is the most remarkable female-driven Western I've seen since Johnny Guitar. Only in this case, I mean it as a compliment. You know, if you saw Johnny Guitar with Joan Crawford and Mercedes McCambridge, it's kind of terrifying.
Horrible movie.
But beloved. But this one is very good. Costner is a retired lawman, and they play grandparents who are trying to protect their grandson when their ex-daughter-in-law marries into a very scary off-the-grid family. And it's a really terrific piece of work. Oh, and speaking of off-the-grid characters, a couple of weeks ago, I had a great talk with actor Graham Greene, who is, of course, nominated for an Oscar for his role in Dances with Wolves. He plays the head of a mountain clan in the new INSP Western mystery, Blue Ridge, which is available for sale on download all over. Both of these interviews, of course, are heading to True West magazine. The event I have to talk about, the big event, I should say, I have to talk about begins a week from Friday, the Lone Pine Film Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Now, of course, the bad news is that it has to be done online instead of in person.
Mm-hmm.
But the excellent news is that because it's done that way, many more people can take part. Because the problem with Lone Pine has always been that there are so few accommodations that you had to, like, make reservations a year in advance.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now you just have to go to the festival's website, buy your ticket, and get Vimeo links for the watch parties. All of the panels and screening and events are going to be available all weekend whenever you want to see them.
Oh, fantastic.
And the centerpiece is the premiere of the 4K restoration of Roy Rogers' final film, 1975's McIntosh and TJ.
Oh, wow.
Which is, it's a terrific picture. His last Republic Western.
It truly is a good movie. Yeah. I nothing like Roy Rogers you would expect.
No, it's, you know, it's funny. I was talking to his daughter, Cheryl, and she said, you know, I didn't realize that he could really act. He just, mm-hmm. you know, had that personality, that character he played in all of his movies, which I
right.
love. But it's a whole different thing. I think this is his best work since Raoul Walsh's The Dark Command in 1939.
Right. And you know, there's no trigger in it when he comes driving up in a beat up old pickup.
That's true, but there are a lot of horses and a lot of horse breaking.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, 23 years between movies. It is a terrific piece of work. I get to moderate a discussion on the making of it with Roy and Dale's daughter, Cheryl Rogers Burnett, and the producer's son. And our mutual friend, Courtney Joyner, is going to lead a panel with the stars from the film that include Larry Mahon,
uh-huh.
Andy Robinson. Oh, you remember Larry, the great rodeo guy.
Yeah.
From Eugene, Oregon, I think.
That sounds right.
Yeah, and he had a boot label for a long time. I have a bunch of boots with his name
boots,
in them.
Yeah.
Very cool. And TJ himself. Clay O'Brien, who of course became a huge rodeo champion himself, and one of the original cowboys from The Cowboys, is going to be taking part.
Excellent.
I'm sorry?
I said excellent.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
I thought you said which one. I was happy because I was able to tell you he's Party Fimps in it. The one that says, I hope I didn't wear, you know. Wear off the fight of him or something to that effect. Now, the last bit of news that I have tonight is that Mark Gordon Productions has announced that they're developing A Fistful of Dollars as a TV series. They've acquired the rights not only to Sergio Leone's film, which, of course, made an international star Clint Eastwood, but they've also acquired the rights to Akira Kurosawa's samurai film Yojimbo, which Fistful of Dollars is a remake of.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Now, Bron Cogman, one of the writers on Game of Thrones, has been hired to write the script.
Oh, wow.
You know, Kurosawa always made a big stink when Fistful became a big hit because Leone never bought the remake rights from him. But to me, he's really in no position to criticize, considering Yojimbo is a samurai version of, anyone remember what? He stole it. He did not buy the rights. Dashiell Hammett's gangster novel, Red Harvest.
Oh.
Yeah. And you can read all about these stories and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Thank you so much, Mr. Park.
It's my pleasure, Mr. Christina.
It's always fun having you on our first Monday of the month, and we'll be seeing you 1st of November.
I look forward to it in roughly four weeks.
That's right. Roughly 4 weeks.
Take care,
friend.
Guys.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay. Bye-bye, Bobby.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Well, you know, Bobby and I often, the last two or three weeks, we've been gushing about books. This week is not going to be any different. we're getting used to reading about the dead. So, I mean, you know, this book was like, it invited us to join the dead. For lack of a better term, this week's author is the award-winning author of the Dead series, including Debriefing the Dead, which is the book that Bobby and I read, 2019 Royal Palm Literary Award gold medalist for Best Published Fantasy, 2019 In Detail Magazine Roan Award for Best Long Paranormal, 2020 Reader's Favorite Bronze Medal for Best Urban Fantasy, and 2019 Romance Writers of America Rita Award finalist. And his sequel, Waking the Dead, which we have not read, is a 2020 Roan Award finalist for Best Long Paranormal and NN Light Book Award winner, which In Detail Magazine recommends for fans of television shows like Constantine or Supernatural. That's all I'm going to go into. This woman is, she's a teacher. She's a mother. She's a wife. She has a dog, a couple of dogs, I think. When I caught her on Tuesday, she was walking the dog, which is, sounds like a song to me. Would you please welcome to the writer's block, Carrie Blaisdell.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I have multiple dogs.
Yeah. Well, I only have one. That's enough. Once I finally could sit down, it's getting harder and harder and harder to sit down and read it. I'm sure Bobby Jean will say the same thing. As you get older, life gets busier. I don't know how that works, but it does.
I totally agree.
Oh yeah. But once I got into this book, it grabbed me and wouldn't let me quit reading. And I was kind of curious. One question I wanted to ask right off the bat was, were you sitting in a flower garden when you wrote this book? Because you have a hyacinth, a rose, a lily, and what else?
The thing is that my character names generally sort of just come to me, but they also always have some kind of either deeper symbolism or something that's in my own head anyway, some sort of like inside joke or something. Like names always, the naming of my characters is always important. Whether it's like obviously important in the story, whether it's just something, you know, about their character or a quirk or something. If you read others of my books, you'll see that there's like everybody just has like weird names. Like it's a name that sounds like it should be a quote girl's name, but it's a guy, or, you know, vice versa. There's just always something with names. So yeah, Hyacinth and Lily just kind of came to me, and then as did their last name. So I'm like, sure. But I did actually do a lot of the writing outside. I like to sit on my deck in the summer and write. So you're not wrong. I was outside for large portions of it.
Well, all right then. I have to say though, the French names did not come easily to my tongue. My palate fought them every inch of the way. And I just finally gave up, and I just read them. I just looked at the name, read the letters, and moved on.
that kind of took over too. But I mean, you know, it starts out in France, and so there's a lot of, there's some French characters that have to be there.
Yeah, well, the fact that Hyacinth is a rare antiquities dealer and a thief, which I loved. I loved the dichotomy of the character. I mean, she was good, bad, and kind of middle of the road all at once. And she was a terrific, gutsy lady. Mm-hmm. And one of the best lines in the entire book was, I think it was the end of chapter 3, four words, and then I died. Wow. I go, wow. Okay.
Yeah, you're not expecting that in a first person book usually, right?
And you go, whoa. Your characters have, every single one of your characters, you don't like them initially, and then you do like them, and then you don't like them again. Bobby, you found that too.
I think that's a compliment.
And, you know, and Jason, we never knew exactly what Jason's deal was.
Yeah, what's his story?
And then we were totally wrong until the end of the book, and then we were kind of wrong.
Well, you know, okay. I just wanted to comment when you said about that chapter, Jim, and yes, like Jim, when I started reading this, I actually started reading it within half an hour of last week's show, which was with another phenomenal book. And right away, this book grabbed me and I got to that chapter. And, you know, before I read on, I just thought to myself as a reader, I thought to myself, so what voice will be next? Is this right. a story that's going to be told in a variety of voices? Or, you know, how is she going to, where are we going to go from here? And so, of course, it was interesting to see that that character continues, you know, through the whole book.
Right.
But there were, you gave us a lot of red herrings. You do give us some clues. Like Jim said, I did find myself going back, having to go back occasionally, be like, now, wait a minute, or where are we now? Wait a minute, how did we get here? We're on the boat. Oh, how did we get here?
You know, when Hyacinth shot, I had to go back, and she'd said, and then I died. I had to go back. I had to kind of read that again to see if I got it right the first time. I said, wait a minute, no, that can't be. I mean, I saw Lily get shot. Lily took one in the back of the head. She was pretty much gone. But I just, wait a minute. No, Hyacinth can't get killed because she's like the protagonist.
Well, I was wrong.
Apparently.
Didn't you love that scene when she's outside and she sees a neighbor and he's kind of wandering and he's not sure like where he's supposed to go. And so you're thinking, wait a minute, you know, so what's the deal with him? You gave us a lot of interesting things to think about as a reader.
You didn't mention that Jason didn't see the neighbor, but you knew at halfway through the book, okay, nobody saw the neighbor either except for Hyacinth, because he also was dead.
And then Hyacinth suddenly, you know, she thinks back to that moment and she sort of has an aha moment, because at that moment she didn't really totally get what was going on exactly, and then she thinks back to it, and I found that again helpful as a reader, because sometimes she'd be rethinking something and I'd be like, yeah, what about that?
I had a lot of fun with those scenes, and I'll be honest, like a lot of it just came out, like I don't, like, you know, people ask writers all the time, where did you get the idea for this or whatever, and I don't know if you guys were thinking of asking me this, but I'll just tell you right now, like a lot of that I go back and I read it and I'm like, where did that come from? It came out,
I can tell you where it came from. It came from the characters. They're the ones that gravitate you towards certain pieces in the book. They're the ones that tell you where they're going next.
And I'm definitely a character-driven writer,
I think most writers are, if they're writing a good novel.
I agree. I find that writers that say that they're completely 100% plot-driven, if their book is really good, that may be how they started, but I doubt that it's the entire story, because I think that their characters help them with the plot.
I don't care if you outline... as long as you know where you're going to start and you know where you're going to finish, always give room for your characters to change the story on you, because they're going to.
Exactly.
So, the question that I actually have, and I ask a lot of writers this, usually it's the first one out of the bag. I waited a little bit tonight to ask this one to you. But first, we're going to take a little break. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina. And right now, we're going to hear a little word from LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Talk Radio. You're listening to LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block. And I am your host, Jim Christina. And you know, in this time of COVID-19, when everybody is locked down and working from home, getting tired of that old terrestrial AM talk radio stuff and TV, how about this? How about you log on to LA Talk Radio? See, we've got some of the best talk, music, sports, self-help, and, you know, just about anything that your little heart desires right here at LA Talk Radio. So why go any further? Why not just sit back and listen to what our hosts and our shows have to tell you? So that's LA Talk Radio, and it's found at latalkradio.com, and listen to The Writer's Block every Thursday night, 6 p.m., right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are back. It is now 6:15, actually 6:16 in the evening. And We are on the phone with writer Kerry Blaisdell. And if you want to call in and talk to Kerry tonight, the number in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, get a pencil, as Bobby Jean used to say. Number is 323-203-0815. And we promise we will try our best to get you on the air with Kerry. Okay, the question now, Kerry, are you ready?
Yes.
Where do all these
lay it on me.
Where do all these dead people come from? Where in your little heart
in my head
did you actually come up with all these dead people, and why? Well, I'll tell you why, because it's a great story. But how? I mean, it's
you know, like I said before, you know, I had this idea. Like, you know how you just have like this little germ of an idea, and the sort of visualization I had was sort of like, you know, the Archangel Michael is the one who's supposed to be taking souls up to heaven or down to hell and you know, various things. And I thought, that must be a really busy job. What if there was somebody who like helped him out, or what if that was a thing? And then that just sort of like became this story with Hyacinth, where she dies and she's starting to see, you know, dead people around her that she had no idea were just kind of wandering around. And, you know, the individual instances of them, I couldn't tell you. They just showed up. They're like, hey, okay, I'm next. You know, that's like pretty much how it happened.
Well, you done good.
Thanks.
You done good.
Well, I did wonder to myself, what would it be like if suddenly I was confronted with Saint Michael in my bathroom, and you know, and he makes these surprise appearances. How did you? This is a book that we want everybody to read, so we don't want to spoil anything. And there are lots of twists and turns. It would be easy to let the cat out of the bag, so we'll do our best not to do that. But in creating the character, for instance, of Saint Michael, and you've got some others that sort of have their sort of grounded in theology, like the Feast of Saint Michael and so forth. How did you? Sure. What did you do a lot of? And you also take us a lot of places. So tell me a little bit, maybe, about the research, if you did. Or it just all comes to you naturally, the research for this book, the places, as well as the character, like a St. Michael.
Sure. So, I mean, basically the short answer is I got into a whole lot of internet rabbit holes of research where I was like, I thought I was researching just like one thing, like, you know,
God,
I don't know what, like what kind of shoes would Archangel Michael wear or something. And then that led to this, and then, like, you know, 2 weeks later I was like, there's all this stuff in the story that it just sort of like it flowed. I will say that my background is I have a degree in comparative literature, and I studied at least French was my major language for my literature, but my secondary language was medieval English, and I really did almost 50-50, which is a little unusual. It was at UC Berkeley, and their degree is set up a little differently, but with comparative literature in particular, their department was a very small department. So basically, if you were a student in comparative literature, you took classes in all these other departments, and then you had to meet certain requirements, and that got put together to be your actual degree, you know, your group of classes that qualified you to earn your degree. And I have always been fascinated by ancient history and ancient religion and how one religion might like take over and incorporate other religions, which is basically what Christianity did, right? Where, you know, it's like, it's not like suddenly that like there was nothing and all of a sudden there's Christianity. It was like, oh, this stuff happened. And then the early Christians went around and they were actually very smart. And instead of saying, oh, we're going to kill your religion, we said, hey, what if this part of your religion actually was part of our religion? And So I've always, like, that's always been in the back of my mind. So from that standpoint, it was a very natural thing to kind of come up with these It's not conscious. It's not like I thought to myself, I'm going to do this, this, and this theme from theology or whatever. But it all kind of came out organically. And as for the research part, I did research extensively as much as possible. I mean, a lot of this stuff is rooted in mythology and conflicting reports and different things. So it's my own interpretation, but I did do a lot of research about early Christianity because there's some themes that I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying there's Archangel Michael shows up pretty early. So you're going to notice there's some Christian themes in this, early Christianity themes. Mm-hmm. But it's not a religious book. I'm fascinated by the history, you know, the history and how all of this evolved. So yes, I did do a lot of research, and then at some point you have to kind of shut off the research and go, okay, whatever I've got, I've got to make my interpretation, and the characters got to do what they got to do. The actual character of Archangel Michael is another one that it's like, if you read the whole book, I didn't intend him to be that way, but he just sort of came out that way where he did. He starts popping in on her and, you know, doing these surprise visits. And if you read the second book, that gets worse. It gets like way worse.
So it was like a Woody Allen movie.
There's some kind of a little bit of humor. It's not that he's a funny guy at all, but the scenes with him are, even though they're talking about, you know, some heavy kind of stuff, they're also, I found them a light touch.
Right.
And I only had one more question about research. And then, Jim, I'll right back over and quote. And some were biblical, although not all. Some were theological or by religious writers. And I just was curious, did the idea for that particular quote come to you before you wrote the chapter, or because they all really work beautifully with the subject of the chapter?
Thank you. I will say 99% of those, or 90%, whatever. Yes, it's sort of like I didn't want to have a blank canvas, so I found the quote that I knew was going to direct the chapter, and then I started with the quote. I knew where the plot was going, so I had an idea of what quote to look for, but it kind of set the tone for what I was looking for. There were one, two, three. It took me, I had written the chapter, and I really, you know, knew where that was going, and then went back and found the quote. But for the most part, it's like I, you know, finished the previous chapter, whatever number we're on, and I really couldn't start writing until I went and found the quote. Which may sound crazy or weird or something, I'm not sure, but it was just like that was part of my process with that book. The second book was very similarly written, where I did a lot of getting the quotes first. I just almost at the end of finishing the third book right now, and that one was very different. The third book, I actually ended up, I did that process through about chapter 9 or 10, and then suddenly it was just like, I've got to write, and then I had to go back later and get the quotes. But I do try, I definitely try, and it's not random. I don't go out and go, oh, I just need a quote, and I put something there. The quote has to have some kind of meaning or tie-in to what the chapter is about for me.
I mean, I've started a lot of books with quotes, but started them. I'm not one every chapter, although I did do a book that had a journal entry that opened every chapter. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I so wildly different from this series, I also have a romantic suspense novel out, Publish or Perish. And that one, I also do quotes, and each start of the chapter, it's a rhyming couplet about a different saint. And if you actually pull all the quotes out and put them together, they make like the first chapter, the final word of those two lines rhymes with the final word of the quote for the next chapter.
Oh, cool.
So if you take them all out, they make a rhyming poem. And I was very proud of that. Like, I don't think actually notices it when they're reading it, because, you know, you read the quote, you read the chapter, you read the next quote, you read the next chapter, but I'm proud of the fact, and they tie in. And that was like, that was a tear my hair out thing, because I had to rewrite parts of that, and I had to move things around, and I'm like, no, I have to move the quote. That's not going to rhyme. You know?
That's so
anyway,
cool.
Anyway, sorry.
Did that drive your editor crazy?
Well, that one, the publisher Parrish is indie published, so I was my own editor. So
okay.
Yes, it drove me crazy. I've definitely got that writer split personality thing going on where I'm like, my characters talk to me, the writer in me talks to me, my editor in me talks to me. Sometimes we don't agree with each other, but it's all me, so it's all good. With the Dead series, that is with a publisher, and I have an awesome and amazing editor who basically, like, she points out all the things that I'm doing wrong with my grammar and things like that, and then she asks me pointed questions about plot and consistency and stuff, and then I come back and say, no, I have to have it this way, and she's like, well, that's fine, I was just pointing it out, you know. So she's awesome. Now, she has really good ideas too, so it's not like I'm always ignoring her or something, but it's generally like,
yeah,
you know, the way she asks me is very much like, you know, would it be better if this happened, or this is confusing or something, and then, you know, we figure it out. But the quotes was never an issue.
I have one of those too. She actually lives in the same house as I do.
Nice.
She will bring me red lines OTA. I'll give her a chapter and half of it will be redlined. And she goes, you know, that this doesn't work because that, you know, two chapters back, he said something else.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. You know, right. We all do it. And that's why we rely on editors, and don't edit your own stuff. You know, cause
yeah.
if you made a mistake, you're not going to catch it.
Yep.
But I do like using quotes as to start books. I always thought that definitely had to link into the story.
Yeah.
And
the ones
that I have picked so far linked pretty good to the story.
Mm-hmm.
Not always perfect, but hey, it can't always be perfect. One of my favorites,
yeah,
though, is I made up half of it. The Road to Perdition is paved with, but it's not what you think it's going to say. It's the road. My quote is, the road to perdition is paved with righteous bodies, the bodies of the righteous.
Oh,
there you go.
Nice.
So anyway, you know what, this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. I'm your host, Jim Christina. We're on the phone with Miss Carrie Blaisdell. We'll be back with Carrie in just a minute, but right now we're gonna have a word from out west.
Readers want tonight's featured titles, Debriefing the Dead and Waking the Dead, Books 1 and 2 of the Dead series by Carrie Blaisdell, or any books by the Writer's Block featured authors, easy. Just go to www.outwestshop.com. Choose books and CDs from the toolbar. From the drop-down menu, click Shop Out West on bookshop.org.
Bobby,
the Writer's Block.
Caller.
I'm sorry?
Can you finish in a minute? We do have but never mind. A caller drops. Finish your ad.
The Writer's Block book list features titles of our guests. Click a book cover for the link to our interview and to purchase. Explore all our book categories. We add new titles daily. One Stop Shopping supports Out West and independent booksellers when you purchase books through our bookshop.org affiliate website. Remember, it's always a great day Out West.
It is indeed. Sorry about the interruption, Bobby, but Ronan just popped in and said we had a caller.
Well, I could see something was happening on my screen, but I couldn't look over there.
Yeah, and well, you know, it is what it is. All right, now it's 6:31, and this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block, and if you want to call, I'm sorry, the caller that you can call back, the number here in the studio is, what is it, 323-203-203-0815. Again, that number is 323-203-0815. And, you know, as long as we're talking about books, Out West has a great selection of reading materials, books. I mean, they have all mine. Thank you, Bobby. They have, and pretty much every guest on our show, you can't find it in Out West. I'll tell you what, I'm a firm believer. Go to Amazon. They've got it, and they make it easy to shop there, just like Bobby does at Out West. So if you can't find a book at Out West, shoot over to Amazon. I'm sucking up to Amazon because I'm trying to get them to sponsor us. So there you go. All right.
The truth comes out.
nothing matter with that, is there? Okay. All right. The question I have for you, Carrie, is this is a question that we've asked the last, I guess, three or four writers on the air. When you're writing, I know what I do, but do you write for your personal gratification? Do you write for your readers? Or do you write for your ego?
Interesting. You know, probably a combination of the three. This book in particular, Debriefing the Dead, was basically, I had been trying for a long time to get published and writing things that I thought might be saleable. I mean, I definitely have like a different voice and a different thought process than I think a lot of like the sort of mass market type published books. So I was never like trying to completely write to the market, but I was trying to get published and I was trying to write what I thought would get me published, and it wasn't getting me anywhere. I was getting close sometimes and then getting rejections and various things. And I was getting kind of, I don't know, frustrated is not really the right word, but like, you know, I was getting kind of down about the whole thing. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I've been writing since before I could read. I used to dictate stories to my dad, who would write them down for me. And then I would illustrate, you know, I would draw these, you know, little pictures to go along with it or whatever. So I've been a writer forever. And I just thought, I'm just going to write what I want to write. And if it gets published, great. If it doesn't, oh well. So from that standpoint, you know, I was writing for my own gratification because I was just like, I just need to write. But, you know, I wanted to be published and I wanted people to read the book. So I was, you know, certainly hoping for that. I would say at this point with this series, with book three, I am at least partly writing for the readers in that, like, I'm not changing anything as I write, but it does, as I'm writing, I'm thinking, you know, oh my gosh, I've got people who are invested in this story and who are invested in these characters. Are they going to get really mad at me if this happens? You know, so it's a little bit of a struggle because my stories are character driven. So what happens, happens. And sometimes it's some surprising things that I was not intending, but there's definitely a little bit of a something, you know, sitting on my shoulder watching me right now that I didn't used to have. The ego part, I'll cop to that. Yeah, you know, like I said, I want to be read and I want people to like my books and things like that. So it's a nice little boost when I get, you know, a nice review on Amazon or, you know, 5 stars on Goodreads or something like that. So, but I'm basically an introvert. I'm not shy, of course, but as you can tell, because I'm chatting away here, but I basically like to, you know, kind of sit in my bat cave or in my case, my deck with my dogs around me and just enjoy the writing process. So the writing I do for me, the stories, maybe a little bit for, you know, the readers, and then, you know, there's that ego thrown in there too. So
that's actually a very good answer. And we love writers. We love writers like you because you make it easy for us to ask you questions.
I got one.
Good.
Well, okay. Gee, yes. Okay.
this book is just full of imagination. And even though there's some research involved, and I just wondered, I don't know that we've ever asked this too much. What do you do, if you do anything, to sort of grow your imagination, to keep feeding it so that as you sit down to work, you have fertile ground under your feet?
That's a great question.
That's a great question. That's an interesting question. I would say that the biggest thing for me is that I just, like, I never want to stop learning. I'm curious about just about anything. And, you know, one of the things when I talk about being an introvert, because that's actually another thing I'm very interested in, is the difference between introverts and extroverts. And I have a daughter who's like wildly extroverted and, you know, various things. But what I always say is that I'm not shy and I can talk to anybody about anything. And what I really mean is that I'm interested in listening to other people talk and listening to their stories. My mother, I come from a relatively small family. I'm an only child. My mother comes from a very large family. She only has 3 siblings, but her mother has something like 42 first cousins.
Oh my gosh.
Extended family, just huge. Like, I think my grandmother was the youngest of it was like 12 or 13, but several of them died in the flu epidemic 100 years ago. So she didn't have that many surviving siblings. But then, you know, between all her cousins, you know, her cousins and everything. So I spent a lot of, I grew up on the West Coast, but I spent a lot of time going back to the Midwest and visiting extended family. And I love talking to people. I love hearing stories. I love hearing, whether it's family stories or stories about, you know, the area that I'm in, or if my husband and I take a trip somewhere, I'll talk to the shop owner about something. So I think that's one thing that I do. I used to read extensively, as Jim said, you know, the older we get, the busier we get. And I keep thinking, like, I just got my youngest daughter off to college just 2 weeks ago. And I keep thinking, maybe when I'm an empty nester, I won't be quite so busy. But I have a full-time job as a teacher,
right,
as well as being a writer, which I think also helps, because I'm around 11 and 12 year olds before COVID shut everything down. I was around 11 and 12 year olds, and they also like to talk, and they also like to learn, and they also like to share things. So, you know, I listen to podcasts, I watch TV, I try all kinds of different genres and shows and things. If you ask me what my favorite kind of music is, I can't tell you, because I like, there's no music genre that I don't like. Mm-hmm. There's individual songs that I don't like, and individual, maybe perhaps styles of something that aren't my favorite. But if it's good music, I like it. If it's a good book, I like it. I don't care what genre it is. If it's a good television show, or, you know, whatever, I like it. So I just have a very wide, wide range. And I always have, like, I've never been, like, for instance, when I'm a math teacher, my degree is in comparative literature with French and English. So naturally I'm a math teacher. Like, you know, I don't, my brain just works that way. It's just like, well, you know, when I went to college and I took the SATs, I actually did better on the math SAT. I did well on both, but I did better on the math portion than I did on the English portion. And when I decided to become a teacher, which is a second career for me, I was interviewing at the grad school, and they were like, well, you know, your degree would indicate English teacher, but there's a lot of English teachers, and I see that you did really well on the math SATs, and I've always loved math. Like, I was like, you know, sort of almost 50-50, I'm going to do something with math from a major, and then I was just like, yeah, I love it, but I don't think I want to major in it. So they basically convinced me, you know, you should go take the middle school math test and see if you could get certified, and if you can get certified in that, then we can stick it on your degree, and then you'll have this degree where you can teach, you know, English, or you can teach math. And then the placement director was like, well, it's not that common to have somebody who's an English and a math teacher. So why don't you go take the social studies test and see if you can pass that. And then if you took the science test and passed that, then you'd be certified for like everything in middle school. Wow. And so I was like, sure, why not? And I actually did pass all of them. And then my placement, my English placement was with a teacher who also taught speech. So I went and took the speech test. So I'm certified. So it's basically just like, I'm interested. Like, it's fun. It's like, wow, that would be, yeah, it'd be cool to be a speech teacher. I'll go see if I can pass the speech test, you know? Jeez. So that's what I do. It's like exercise for my brain or something. I just never let it sit on the couch and buy.
you remind me of my seventh grade history teacher, that she made us learn the French national anthem and then sing it.
Oh, wow.
And none of us spoke French.
That's funny. Yeah, I had a physics teacher.
So it's just like, holy crap. And you know what? I can't remember anything. I can remember the tune.
Uh-huh.
But I can't remember any of the words.
I can remember the opening line, and that's it. That's the only one I know. And I studied French, so, you know, you would think I would know, but
it's like the Canterbury Tales. I had to learn the entire thing in Old English.
Oh.
Yeah. I read it in Old English. That was fun, but it was also a challenge.
Well,
I don't remember any of it.
English, your tongue isn't made for Old English.
No, I know.
Let's see. We just have to recite it. One April de Shora Sota, the drogs of Marta Persa to the Rota, Mother of Ivan and Sweet Liqueur, which fair to engendered is
pretty good.
Oh my gosh.
That's pretty good. That's like, so I had to do, When I was in seventh grade, I had to learn a poem in French, and we were studying fables. So I can still do most of the fox and the crow, or the whatever. Yeah. So anyway, I could do most of that in French. But
interesting.
So the question we have for you tonight, Carrie Blaisdell.
Yes,
if you've listened to our show, then you know where the question is coming. This is the writer's block, and there's a reason it's called the writer's block. Have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get rid of it? Now, remembering your spew, go.
Okay. So yes, all the time in terms of have I ever had it. How I got past it, you know, it varies. I have a couple sort of techniques that I do. One of the most basic ones actually is I just try and think like my character, or just try to sort of be my character. And I don't think this would spoil anything, but there's, you know, not every time, but there's a few places in my books where you might see Hyacinth going, I don't know what to do. And that was literally like, I'm in my head going, I don't know what to write next. And then, you know, just by putting myself into Hyacinth's place, sure, she doesn't know what to do either. Like, I don't know what she's going to do. She doesn't know what she's going to do. She has to think it through. And so that's one trick I have, is I just start kind of doing that, and that kind of gets the ball rolling, and then stuff comes out and I get past it. The other thing is sometimes I just have to shut my laptop down and go outside for a walk, or just do something physical around the house. I can sit for hours and write, but I'm generally at I don't like to sit all the time. I need to get up and move. So I'll just go clean the kitchen for 15 minutes or go walk. We have a split entry house, so our deck is on the second story. So I'll go outside and I'll just walk up and down my back stairs outside so that I get some air and some sun and some exercise. So sometimes that helps. Because sometimes I just go back and I reread the previous chapter. I'm definitely an edit as I go kind of person. So that can actually create its own kind of writer's block. New writers, watch out for this. You can spend, you know, 29,000 hours editing and re-editing and
stuff,
trying to make the first five chapters 100% perfect, when really what you need to be doing is just writing the imperfect sixth chapter so that you can keep going.
Exactly.
And I have a lot. This third book in the series has taken me way too long to finish, partly because of a number of personal and national crises this year that just kind of, like, I'm just like, 2020 needs to end. It needs to go away. But I had quite a bit of writer's block with this book, just because it's, you know, the first book I just wrote. The second book I wrote before the first one was actually published. So I could actually, if there was something that came up in the second book, I could go back and fix it in the first book, or I could change something, or I could drop a hint about something in the first book. Now both of those books are published and out there, and I'm writing the third book in this increasingly complex and sort of, you know, mushrooming series of things. And I have to constantly kind of go back and go, when did so-and-so know this? Or when did this happen? And, you know, occasionally I've caught myself, like you said, you know, somebody didn't say something that, you know, you thought they said, and your live-in editor caught it or whatever. It's that kind of thing where I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That person didn't exist then, or, you know, wasn't part of the story then, or, you know, whatever. So, it's been a little bit, like, there's parts of it that have just been wonderful and flowy and easy to write. And there are parts of it where I feel like I write like three words and then I have to put it down for like a week. And then it's like, you
there
know,
you
coming
go.
Back to it. So the biggest thing I would say, and I need to follow my own advice. I don't always follow my own advice, but the biggest thing is to just not stress about the, I don't know if I can say the S word on radio. So I'll say, don't stress about the bad first draft.
Don't sweat shit. It's all small shit.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Don't. Yes. You know, the shitty first draft you just got to get it out there, and then you can fix whoever, Nora Roberts or somebody, I think, is the one who said, you know, you can fix a written page, you can't fix a blank page, and that's 100% true.
Right.
If you never write it, then you can't fix it. So
I need to take another real quick break, and don't go away. Please, please, please don't go away, Gary. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. And now let's get a brief word from Creative Edge.
When Creative Edge was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't going to be the same as other publicity firms. No, sir. You see, the folks at Creative Edge, they work closely with their individual clients, their needs, and their goals, pushing them harder and to get them noticed and get them booked. They believe communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is exactly how they have built their success. They work on the I can do that better, and they have indeed done just that. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand, it's your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, and you can find them at creative-edge.services.
And we are back. And if you do need a publicist, I would recommend strongly you go with, you give Mickey a call or go to his website and give me act two. Okay. Yeah. Well, do you know Mickey?
No, but I was going to say that I was sitting there listening to that thinking, gosh, it would be nice to have somebody doing this for me, take some of that off my plate.
Well, you know what? He's not very expensive, and he's a great publicist. You may want to give him a try.
I might do that.
Yeah. It's really my edge. Okay, we're about out of time. Actually, we are out of time. Carrie, thank you. I have so many more questions I wanted to ask.
I know.
Sorry, I talked too much.
Thank you for... You did really well. I mean, like I said, we're a friendly crew. You can pretty much do what you want. It's really nice having you with us. And your evening in Oregon there is in big old bad Beaverton. It's been nice having you, and I'm glad you gave up your hour to come and visit with us.
Awesome.
Get a hold of the bookie. Thank you. And get a hold of the bookie, and she can rebook you at a different time next year, and we'll get you back on the show.
Oh, that'd be fun. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because we want to rebook two, and we want to rebook three.
And three.
I wish it was coming out sooner. I'm so mad at myself that it's not coming out sooner, but it'll be out as soon as I can get it out.
Yeah.
Well, publishers sometimes, they're not going to, they lie to you. What are you going to do? Okay.
It's I'm the holdup. It's not my publisher. It's me. But they'll get it out as soon as they can, as soon as I get it to them. I just haven't got it to them yet. That's me.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you again so much for joining us. And next week, I don't know who we have next week. The bookie didn't give me the info.
I don't either.
Wait a minute. Yeah, Russ is on.
Yeah, because I think he and I switched maybe for next week, so I don't know.
She's on next week with me. You're on the following week.
I'm back on the third week. Yeah.
You are. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. This has been a hoot, and Carrie has been a wonderful guest. And Bobby Jean, always a pleasure talking to you. And I found out that all the drugs that I'm taking give me a lisp.
Oh, really? I hadn't noticed that.
It's going away. It's going away now. It's almost gone. But I was sure noticing it in some of the things I was doing. You go, wait a minute, who the hell is that? But anyway, from Bobby Jean Bell and Russ Avison, myself, the Writer's Block, LA Talk Radio, Ronan Rossner, and of course, Sam Hassan, we are out of here.